Today's sponsor is Audible. With an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more, get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at audible.com/GOT.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're here to do our 701 spoiler cast, spoiler edition of the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Aaron's got, I presume, a lot of just really amazing, mind-blowing stuff prepared for all of us.
Sure, sure.
Myself included.
You know, one thing, as I got some feedback from international fans, and I guess however they watch it in England... In the UK, they don't get the next time-ons. So they said, if you do talk about the next time-ons, can you at least describe them?
Really?
So I thought maybe we could each week start off with a description of the next time-ons, and we can kind of go through and talk about it.
Well, here's the thing. If you're watching this on cable, you're doing it wrong. Because I couldn't believe when I went to watch this first episode of the season, I was going to watch it live on our cable service, and I turned it on, and it was so muddy and shitty.
That's because you're watching the SD channel.
No, I was watching HBO HD.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it was muddy and shitty and crappy just compared to... I turned on our Roku and I watched it on the HBO Go service. Looks 1,000 times better.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think you get the previously on if you watch on HBO Go. So try that, UK
fans.
Well,
the thing is, is HBO Go international?
I think so, but I couldn't swear to it.
That's
the
thing. Like, yeah, I'm sure. Like, if it's not, people are going to be like, "You fucker, we don't have HBO."
Well,
Go.
Sucks to be you. You're watching the muddy version with no previously.
Welcome to the Ugly American Podcast. Anyway, let's talk about this. So, the preview for next week has Jon Royce of the Vale declaring a Targaryen cannot be trusted as Jon looks vexed. They're trying to bait us into thinking Jon has discovered Jon's secret identity, and he's
clearly he's
outed.
Talking about Dany.
Yeah, probably.
Clearly,
probably. Cersei opines that the Mad King's daughter will destroy the realm. Yara Greyjoy says to Dany that we have a fleet and 3 dragons. We should hit King's Landing now. A fierce wolf growls and barks into the camera as Arya looks on transfixed. Some woman throws a knife, who I couldn't identify. Alaria and Yara kiss. Somebody, probably Jon, pits Littlefinger through the walls of what might be the crypts of Winterfell and starts choking him, which I thought was satisfying.
Yeah.
So, a couple things. This wolf, is this the... So, back in season one, we know that Arya set her wolf Nymeria free rather than let her face justice at the hands of her father. Do we think that this is going to be... Because one of the popular theories is that Nymeria... Like Arya's in the middle of making nice with all these Lannisters, and Nymeria is going to come in with her wolfhound pack and just tear all their throats out. And Arya is going to, like, remember who she – kind of like, oh, I got a little soft and, you know. Or is that going to be a cautionary tale of what she might become if she lets herself keep going down this path and she's going to turn north back to Winterfell instead of pursue Cersei? Like,
good questions. I feel like that might be a little sudden for book watchers, for show watchers only, to see a pack of wolves jump out of the middle of nowhere and start tearing people up. But it would also be really cool.
Yeah.
Like the return of Nymeria in
I feel like
high
10,
form.
10 seconds of previously on establishing Nymeria. Now, the problem is Nymeria looks nothing like this wolf.
Oh, okay.
Nymeria had a much sweeter... I mean, and of course, they could always change that, but she was...
They recast Nymeria.
They could recast Nymeria to be a vicious wolf. But Nymeria was a little... I don't know. I thought Nymeria is like the best looking of the dire wolves.
Yeah.
Maybe pretty, Lady was, because I don't even remember what Lady looks like. But I was in investigating this, I was comparing Nymeria when we last saw her as Arya is making her go away to this, and like this doesn't seem like it's the same wolf.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that... They just didn't recast her, or Also, you know, Nymir is leading, as a giant direwolf, is leading a pack of normal wolves in the Riverlands. So it could just be one of Nymiria's lackeys, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Nymir comes in there and is like, hey, don't hassle my former human.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe Arya gets her throat ripped out. I doubt it.
Yeah.
I doubt it. It seems like that there is going to be... the other thing is, I don't know what to make of Yara and Ilaria making out.
Like maybe just right place, right time. Like they have the opportunity to do it, so why not?
Well, but if they do that, I hope it's something meaningful for the two characters and not just like titillation. I mean, I guess I'm fine with titillation.
HBO is
too,
known
but...
for that. I mean, Game of Thrones certainly has titillation for titillation's sake.
True.
And Yara has already been established to at least be interested in the same sex.
She's bi curious, flexible, hetero flexible.
So I don't, whatever. It's fine. I am with you. I hope.
Like if Tyrion,
I mean, people
just,
don't have sex for reasons, like, all the time, you know?
That is true.
It's not like you have to have a reason to bone down.
And then that's true, especially when you've got, like, a pirate queen and the the lover of Oberon going ahead. So maybe they don't need reasons. And I'm trying to make – maybe I'm just being a fuddy-duddy about this. I guess what I'm saying is when I got main characters that are – I guess I expect it to mean something. But you're right. There's no – that is a not culturally valid way to look at the thing. Then John, what do you make about John choking Littlefinger out in the halls of Winterfell or maybe even the crypts?
Yeah, so this is something we've long been wondering about. Who's going to bring, you know, to the attention of John his heritage, essentially.
Right.
We think that potentially Littlefinger has that information because of some early scenes in the show. Because
he's just been a little bit side-eyeing Sansa and a little smug when he's been out in the crypts talking about her aunt Lyanna. I don't know. The thing is it's a big question mark about how he would come to that knowledge.
Right.
Now, it might just be
and why he would,
like,
tell John.
Right. It might just be like, huh, Lord Eddard visited the Tower of Joy 9 months after Lyanna was abducted by Rhaegar, comes back with this, you know, child that he won't say who the mother is. I mean, maybe he's just that perceptive.
It could be. I would buy it, I think.
And there's also been a long-running fan theory that there's some kind of, like, were-guild in the crypts of Winterfell.
Were-guild?
Something that you get to make up for some, like a something you take from someone to make up for the death of someone. Like if somebody killed you and then I killed them and stole their car would be a were-guild.
okay.
So
just like John Wick's car.
Yeah. but there's like Rhaegar's famous silver harp is buried with Lyanna. You know, like, but how would Littlefinger know about that? Has he gone down there and just flipped open her tomb on a whim to kind of check it out for himself? I don't know. But it seems like we're getting very close to getting the answers to these questions. We have to. We're no more than 12 episodes away.
Yeah,
it gets one less every week.
It's also possible that Littlefinger isn't the one who tells him, that somebody else has this information, that it gets to John somehow, and he's angry that Littlefinger didn't tell him before. I'm not sure.
The other thing is, like, I have this on big capital letters in big font at the top of my notes, and I somehow skipped over it anyway. I want to address, because I don't know why people thought from our discussion of the leaks that we were going to consider leaks on the spoiler podcast. Because I thought from our tone and tenor that we were pretty anti getting those out and not wanting to see them ourselves. But it's a policy of the Game of Thrones podcast on Bald Move that we consider fair games on a spoiler podcast anything that George Martin has released officially. That includes preview chapters, that includes all of his books, that includes all of the A World of Ice and Fire, A Cookbook of Ice and Fire, all the Hedge Knight stuff, all the comics. It includes anything that HBO has officially released. So trailers for the season, next time ons, things that you can get as a fan that have not been stolen from HBO. The creators did not intend you to know beforehand, because The former are things that are designed to whet your appetite and then have fun theories and speculation. The latter just gives the game away.
Yeah.
So I have, thus far, even though I've been aware of these spoilers, I've been able to avoid them For the most part. I got exposed to one point that I half overheard, and I was able to kind of like fuzz it out, and I'm kind of fuzzy even on the details, and that was the thing that I started realizing people were submitting what I think. I don't know. I can't prove it, but I think people were submitting theories based as speculation. So
yeah.
So now if someone does do that in the future, I guess, and stuff I'm not aware of, it'll just, man, that's the problem. That's the problem I'm really worried about.
How do you
about.
Tell They'll, that?
Yeah, yeah. I won't know. I won't right. know. So I hope no one does that.
Because which is basically asking the internet to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Because the other thing is that even if I am spoiled, because the other thing is I'm worried about is a troll sending me the spoilers, like, in, you know, and I'll read them before I even know what they are.
Yeah.
If I will promise you this, if I do get exposed to the spoilers, I know Jim won't because he doesn't even get the emails. And I will keep it to myself.
Okay.
It will be suck because it'll shut off my ability to speculate on things, but you won't hear any production leaks coming out of this podcast. All right, so let's move on. The other thing I want to talk about, a couple of points before we get to the listeners' feedback, is I thought it was really funny because we talk a lot about the Valonqar prophecy that's only in the books, it's not on the show. That's the other half of Maggie the Frog's prophecy on Cersei, that after all these things that have already come to pass, after she marries the king and has three children, and they die, that a young queen more beautiful than you will come and cast you down, something that also hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, some princesses and queens out there in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is the Valonqar will come and wrap his fingers around your throat and choke the life out of you. Now, the Valonqar is a high Valyrian word that roughly translates to little brother.
Right.
And I thought it was interesting that when we see the establishing shot of Jaime entering that map room, mm-hmm. that Cersei was standing on the part of Westeros that's referred to as the neck. It's where the north and south meets together.
Nice.
And Jaime was standing off what is called the fingers. And to me, that's some pretty solid foreshadowing because Jaime's
like
one of the popular theories because he is technically Cersei's little brother.
By
and it would be
seconds,
very,
but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the fingers are also where Littlefinger comes from. That's why he's called Littlefinger. He's from one of the littler, poorer fingers.
Right.
So when I saw that, because that was in the trailer, I remember laughing at it.
Yeah.
And it's some pretty sick foreshadowing. The other, a lot of people are questioning whether the maester that we meet, that's unnamed, that is tootling Sam, is supposed to be Archmaester Marwyn. So in the book, there is one Archmaester at the Citadel that still dabbles in the black arts and the magic. He's got the Valyrian link on his chain, Valyrian steel link. And in the books, he's important because he's got an unusual amount of students that are floating out there, like Miri Mazdur, the slave girl that ends up betraying Dany and killing Khal Drogo, and she gets burnt to death. She said that she studied under this Archmaster Marwyn and learned about she dissected a body with him, and he taught her all the secrets that lurked under the skin. And also Qyburn, the disgraced maester, was one of his acolytes as well.
Yep.
So don't know for sure. He doesn't like I didn't get a real mystical vibe from this guy.
No.
So I wonder if he'll be set up as like the square maester, like the one who doesn't believe in all this flim flam, and then Sam will find someone that's a little bit more sympathetic, which will be Marwyn.
So you don't think that's this guy?
Or it could be that Marwyn is not going to be, because some of this stuff, it might be dead ends that the Double Ds are trying to pare down. So
could be.
You're just going to, Sam's just going to discover what he discovers at the Citadel without any help and without a lot of discussion about magical candles and all this other stuff. The other question I wanted to we talked about in the podcast, I said that I have that I have more to say about, is the purpose of Beric Dondarrion. Mm-hmm. Because one of the other things I know that you're aware of is book fans for a long time, I think we've kind of given up collectively looking for Lady Stoneheart to pop up.
Yeah.
And Lady Stoneheart is the resurrected body of Catelyn Stark that Arya's wolf, Nymeria, drug out of the river, mm-hmm. and her body was discovered by the Brotherhood Without Banners. And somehow, when they found her, Beric transferred his life force to Catelyn Stark, her body reanimated and she became Lady Stoneheart, and she took the Brotherhood Without Banners down a more dark, vengeful path. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are wondering if the Hound is going to be the Lady Stoneheart of the series, where that, you know, he's going to die. Beric is going to give up his life to reanimate Hound, the Hound, which has the has some implications, because, you know, people were hyped for the so-called Clegane Bowl before. I have to do it live because Jim's refusing to produce it anymore.
I have it. I was gonna put it in last episode. I thought it'd be better to save it.
Oh well, shoot. Yeah. There you go. People have been clamoring for this ever since the Martin dropped hints and dance that the Hound wasn't dead.
Yeah.
Now we know he's alive, and people got excited. But then they banned, you know, Trial by Combat, which is a lot of people thought the Clegane Bowl was going to be Cersei, you know, the Mountain fighting for Cersei, and the Faith choosing their newest monk that's the badass mm-hmm. fighter, the Hound, and they're going to battle. There was a couple scenes in a trailer where it looked like a guy like the Hound might be fighting the Mountain, and the fact that the Hound would be kind of a zombie himself makes that a little bit more symmetrical and a little bit more cool. So I think the Clegane Bowl's back on the table. Everybody get hype.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the Hound fits in, like, to the Lady Stoneheart idea, because he doesn't seem to be the kind of guy at this point who would take them down a more vengeful path.
No, and I feel like that's it, we might be in for a D&D Double D's remix that.
Yeah.
Last year, they already showed the Brotherhood, kind of a splinter faction that's going and being, you know, a little bit darker, a little bit more villainous, and they were punished. And they're gonna keep the mechanic and the passing of the torch of leadership from one to the other, but they're going to, you know, make it be the Hound. And that, you know, that's where mm-hmm. we can start maybe speculating on what's going to happen to books by the show. Like, yeah. Is the Hound going to end up running the Brotherhood? I don't know, because as far as we know in the books, the Hound is still in the Quiet Isle digging graves and serving yeah. his penance for his life of violence. So, mm-hmm. but that's the things I want to talk about. Let's get to the listener feedback. Again, you can send us in GameOfThrones@baldmove.com.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday, join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, quick break to remind everybody about the club, club.baldmove.com, a great way to support us and our independent podcast. And also, we got a celebratory sale for Game of Thrones. Right now, until July 31st, you can get 25% off an annual subscription by going to club.baldmove.com and at checkout entering the promo code GOT2017. It's exclusively for the month of July. When August rolls around, it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gonzo, dunzo. You can get a lot of great features. If you go to that club page, there's actually a showcase of all the different content. There's lots of bonus audio and video content. You can watch us live record the podcast, which is the fastest way to get the podcast. Like, you can't get it any faster than watching us record it.
Yep.
Then you don't have to wait for Jim to edit it. You don't have to wait for it to upload. You don't have to wait for me to write an article. It's just bam, in your eye and ear holes. And again, it's a great, we derived our primary support from our listeners, and that makes us independent. We don't have to worry about offending, too many sponsors. We don't have to worry about offending HBO. We can tell you the straight truth and represent you as a fan, and it's all possible at the club, club.baldmove.com. Thanks in advance for your support. First up, Sebastian. Howdy, guys. I was listening to your preview spoiler podcast, and you wondered how Jon's followers would react if he found out he was a Targaryen and not a Stark. I found this interesting in the context of the first episode where Jon and Sansa go back and forth against the Umbers and the Starks and whether they should be judged based on the actions of their house versus the actions of a single individual within. Jon stands firmly about not punishing all the Umbers and Karr Starks for the actions of a select few individuals. I think Jon's stance in the situation will play a huge role when it's revealed that he is, in fact, a Targaryen. He will be able to use the situation to say, hey, I didn't judge you for your father's or former leader's decisions, so please do the same for me.
Then again, it could be seen as pretty self-serving. You know, who's to say Jon doesn't know?
That's a good point.
Like, if I'm Lil Jon Umber, and I'm sitting back and I'm thinking,
Jon's a Targaryen. What?
Right?
No, I'm serious. He's a Targaryen. What?
I'm thinking, when did Jon find this out, and why was he so keen on not punishing these people?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, it's going to be, I wonder, because you're right. I never thought that the angle of the Northmen might feel betrayed that, like, what, you know, oh, yeah, you just found out you're a secret Targaryen.
Right, sure,
really?
You did, buddy.
Ned never, he kept you hidden in Winterfell this whole time. He never mentioned that.
And like, what if Littlefinger steps up for the good of Sansa and says, no, he knew.
Yeah.
He knew, and then Jon takes him down and starts choking him.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good angle.
Or maybe Littlefinger brings this up to win Sansa over. He tries to undermine Jon,
right?
Which I don't think would work. But
well, and there's that one quote in one of the preseason trailers where Sansa says that, you know, the lone wolf, and when winter comes, the lone wolf freezes or starves, and the pack survives. I wonder, because one of the things I've mentioned in the preview podcast is, if that's her talking about solidarity among the Stark children, that's really badass and cool.
Mm-hmm.
But if she's using that as an excuse to, like, isolate Jon out of the inner circle of trust, like she's talking to Bran and Arya, which is, you know,
that
assumes that there's a reunion and is like, look, we're the pack. He's the lone wolf. He's always been a lone wolf. He's not even part of our family. Like, it can be read two ways depending on the context.
Yeah.
And there's already a lot of people, you know, speculating that maybe Sansa's got another heel turn left in her, or she's going to do something dumb, or she's going to do something that betrays Jon because she's learned too much from Cersei and Littlefinger. Yeah. Who knows?
Maybe. I'm just looking for Littlefinger's pivot, and that could be it.
April from San Francisco. I have questions about Brienne. One, will she fight with Jon beyond the wall? Two, will she become a true knight? And three, what's her purpose now that Sansa's back in Winterfell? For Brienne's arc, even more than ending up with Jaime, I feel like she needs to become a proper knight. She's there with Jon, King of the North, so that should be no problem. But lest we forget, the North doesn't do knightship. Now that's subtle point. That's actually not true. The knighthood is an Andal That's the race, the culture and race of men that came after the first men.
Yep.
That's, and then they brought the faith of seven, and the knighthood is all bound up in that religion. It's like a warrior kind of, you know, religious role. But the knight, the North does have knights. They sometimes allow themselves to be knighted. It's just not seen as big of a deal as it is down south.
As I understand it, the culture of the North is closer to like the free folk culture.
Yeah, right? I mean they're closer to the first men in the way they you know they hold with the old gods. And but still, you like Eve, Ned's master at arms was Sir Roderick.
Mm-hmm.
He got he became an anointed knight somehow and is one of the most respected warriors in the North. So it's not that it never happens. It's just it's a little rarer because they don't seek it.
Yeah, and like I guess I don't view Brienne's natural progression toward knighthood as important for her. Like she's kind of doing the thing that's already in my mind important, which is being the servant of Sansa, like Kat wanted, right? Like she's doing the honor bound thing.
But do you think you're right? Like, you know, it's always one of the whole points of her story is that she embodies the ideals of a knight, even though she's not that path has been blocked to her so far since she's a woman, much more than any other knight that we're kind of familiar with, other than maybe you know, Sir Barristan or guys like that. But I wonder,
what does she want, right?
That's what I'm saying.
That's
like,
the question.
Would it feel like because, you know, you could easily say the Cowardly Lion didn't need a heart at the end. But he still wanted it. He still wanted that little heart medal to get,
that's fulfilling,
you know,
for him. Yeah, so it might be fulfilling for Brienne to become an actual knight.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay.
So that, but she feels, you know, April here feels like that's got to happen. And I don't know. If she's alive, I guess she would be a knight, because why wouldn't she be?
Yeah.
I'm seeing this big throne room ceremony, like Star Wars.
Well, that's the
Wars
thing,
style.
Like, how much of this...
Is she going to be the Chewbacca and just gets boned in the whole award? You know, Chewbacca's sitting there like, what the fuck? I don't get a medal?
Right.
What kind of bullshit anti-Wookiee agenda you got going on, Leia?
She's
going
to be wearing a big bearskin suit, her armor. I wonder how much of the tradition, if, you know, this idea of Dany coming in and breaking the wheel is going to be a thing. I wonder how much of that tradition is even going to be left, you know?
That's true.
Like, will there be a knighthood to even give her
at the end of this thing? Right, since everyone kind of agrees that the knights aren't worth anything, you know? Like,
do they?
Well, I mean, it just seems like that seems to be the common view that, you know, what everyone perceives as a knight and what your average knight actually is and actually does.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, like the Mountain is an anointed knight. Mm-hmm. What the hell does that even mean?
Meryn Trant?
He sworn to protect the innocent and the weak, but he's the biggest raper reaver there is. So
yeah.
She continues, April does. Will she go north of the wall and be one of Jon's 12? Which this is getting into a little bit Azor Ahai prophecy that we're going to get to in an email down the line.
Okay.
She should, as she's an excellent fighter, and she has a Valyrian steel sword, especially given Jon's feminist speech in this episode. Many pixels have been spilled on the identity of the 12 companions with Jon, but I haven't heard much on whether she is one of them. She's always been touted for excellence in battle, and given the equal rights speech, it could happen, but Sansa might want to keep her close as well, as though she was Sansa's very own mountain. Which I suppose ties in the last question, is Sansa going to call all the shots with Brienne? That's a good question. At what point does Brienne start deciding what's best for her to do again?
Right.
She's
already been told her mission is complete.
Right. She's fulfilled her oath. She's kept her oath.
She kind of almost feels like she's idling at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I could see her going north. I could see her...
As long as Littlefinger's around, I feel like she's still in danger. So I'm glad Brienne's
Sansa
around,
is,
but
yeah.
Whenever Littlefinger gets disposed of, whether he goes back to King's Landing, whether Jon chokes him to death in the Crypts of Winterfell, I guess I would be more comfortable with Brienne than doing her own thing.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I also, is Brienne the type of person who would put one girl's life above the entire realm? Because once if she starts believing in this, you know, the long night come again stuff, like, I feel like she'll see it as her duty to go and do something. But
she's sworn to do the other thing.
We see a lot of people up north adventuring. We see Beric, we see Thoros, we see the Hound, and I'm talking about in the preseason trailers. I don't remember seeing Brienne in that group. Now, that could just be because, you know, they're saving a surprise in reserve.
Could be.
I mean, it'd be a shitty trailer if it was 7 hours long and showed the whole season. All right, let's move on to Adam P. I wanted to register my thoughts on Jon Snow and the Sansa plotline, particularly based on the next time preview. Firstly, I think Sansa's dual approach is very, very deliberate, publicly undermining Jon in a way that isn't aggressive but nonetheless noticeable, whilst privately reassuring Jon of her love and support for him.
Really? Wow, the motives of ascribing to Sansa here.
I mean,
wow.
She's kind of a blank slate in that, like, so because he says it's reminiscent of how Baelish played Ned Stark in season one.
Right.
And I guess if you look at the first few episodes of Ned and Littlefinger, you're right. It's not like, you know, I remember thinking, like, maybe he's dumb to trust him, but there was something that Peter did in the first season that I'm like, okay, well, maybe he's true. Oh, I found out he used to love Kat, and I didn't, you know, like, that he's true blue, and he protected Kat and smuggled her into city, and then he pulled a knife. So I'm as dumb as Ned Stark. but I can see where he's going here. He says, I thought her direct reference to Ned and Rob was too on the nose, as though she's teasing John. Like Littlefinger, she's been savaged by the world and has seen good men and women don't win. Did you have to be smart rather than honest to survive and thrive? Now, I didn't get any of her teasing with the reference to Ned and Rob. I thought that was, maybe it's because I agree with the thought that the Stark men have tended to be. People don't like it when I call them dumb.
Too honorable for their own good.
Naive.
Naive, that's a good word.
Like, they think that everyone is as honorable and that their honor means as much as to them, and they don't understand that when you're dealing with the likes of Littlefinger and Cersei and Varys, that you have to keep your cards closer to your vest, because even if you won't cheat playing cards, they sure as fuck will.
Right.
So naive is the word I'll try to use to describe the Stark men's attempting to wield power in the future. This is where the line from the Northerners in episode 2 preview about hating the Targaryens comes into play. Obviously prompted by the dual news of Dany arriving on Dragonstone and Sam's raven about the dragonglass stockpile there, Jon will propose an alliance in order to mine the resources. The vitriolic response will prompt Littlefinger to reveal the true parentage of Jon, which I'm pretty sure Littlefinger knows. My only question is, who is he going to tell? Sansa would be obvious, as he clearly wants her to undermine Jon. John would be more interesting, as he would then effectively have something to blackmail him over. And also that would explain why John is choking him down in the crypts.
Yeah,
Littlefinger's like, I know you're a Targaryen, and I'm going to tell everybody.
Right.
What do you think of that?
I mean, it's speculation. I don't ascribe the motives to Sansa that you apparently do, emailer, because I don't think she's actively trying to undermine John. I think she's trying to do the thing she thinks is right. And she's doing it in the way that Sansa would do it, which is not with a lot of experience. And so she, you know, in that moment, she doesn't understand that by, you know, calling Jon out and stating her opinion on the fact publicly, that she's actually undermining him. She's just doing what she thinks is right. And I can't really fault her too much for that. But I don't think she's trying to play Jon.
Yeah. And
that's not how I read it.
My bias is my personal preference would be for this point in the story that Sansa takes a real leadership role, and I don't see her tearing down Jon as a role of a leader, when Jon obviously has a vital, if not central, role in the war to come. So
that's the thing. The people.
I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't happen, and that I'd even be disappointed. I'm just saying I'm hoping. Yeah. That Sansa, you know, has not a redemptive arc. She doesn't need to be redemptive, but an empowering arc.
Right. Yeah, because maybe she realizes it. I don't know. But what you have to think about is the loyalties and where they lie, because these people aren't loyal to Sansa.
Right.
These people are loyal to Jon because of the acts he's performed, regardless of who he is.
Right.
It's not that they're loyal to the Starks at this point. They're loyal to Jon. So. Right. If she undermines him, she risks losing the entire force of the North.
Right.
And what good does that do anyone, herself included?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if she'll realize that, like you said. Who knows? But
I mean, that's hopefully. The thing. Like, I don't. So that's an interesting question, because, like, I think that the men have a little bit more loyalty towards Sansa than you, because there's a scene in the book where there's one of the hill tribes that are friendly to Ned Stark, and they're marching to the war in Winterfell, and it's. And there's this old guy, and he's like, look, I'm probably not going to survive this winter. If I can go out, bathe in Bolton blood to save Ned's little girl, then that's the way I want to go out. And I feel like that's – if you ask the sentiment of the North of how they feel about Sansa Stark, I think they like her a lot. Now, if they had to choose, if there's a schism, like, do they choose the bastard that led them to victory – in the Battle of the Bastards, or they choose Sansa, who had more than a little bit to do with that victory.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then if you ask, like, what happens if they find out that Jon's a Targaryen that they are instinctively distrustful of, I don't know. But yeah, like I said, I hope that Sansa and Jon don't fight.
Yeah.
Joe Q, seems you guys have often considered the war in the North and the war in the South to be two plot lines completely divorced from each other. A lot of speculation around the remaining two seasons has predicted that this season will be the defeat of Cersei and next season will be about the final battle with the Night King. I'm going to say something crazy. Cersei and the Night King are going to join forces.
Oh, Jesus.
I know this sounds insane, but let me offer an even more bonkers idea. There's already whites, if not a White Walker, in King's Landing. The Mountain. I gotta get better at the horn is what I gotta do. here's what I'm proposing. Sam wasn't the first one at the Citadel to take the White Walker seriously. What if Qyburn has studied the myths and legends and tried to recreate White Walkers on his own? Revive the Mountain, but he built his own makeshift White Walker.
Yeah.
This bonkers theory also brings up the possibility that Cersei doesn't even peacefully align herself with the White Walkers, but controls them in the same way she controls the Mountain. What's really interesting is there's an article that came out this week with Time Magazine interviewing George Martin, and he talks a lot about the books and what he was thinking about it. And I want to read this excerpt. This is George Martin speaking. He says, "It's always bothered me that Gandalf comes back from the dead. The Red Wedding for me in The Lord of the Rings is the Mines of Moria. And when Gandalf falls, it's a devastating moment. I didn't see it coming at 13 years old when I read it. It just totally took me by surprise." And then in the next book, he shows up again, and now he's Gandalf the White. And he's more or less the same as always, except he's even more powerful. I always felt a little bit like a cheat to me. It seems to me that death doesn't make you more powerful, especially if you suffer a violent, traumatic death. They're not going to come back as nice as ever. That's what I was trying to do, and I'm still trying to do with the Lady Stoneheart character. The Times Magazine reporter says, and Jon Snow, too, is drained by the experience of coming back from the dead on the show, and then George says, right, and then poor Beric Dondarrion, who is set up as the foreshadowing of all this, every time he's a little less Beric. His memories are fading, he's got all these scars, he's becoming more and more physically hideous because he's not a living human being. His heart isn't beating, his blood isn't flowing in his veins, he's a white, but a white animated by fire instead of by ice, which now we're getting back to the whole ice and fire thing.
Yeah.
My head kind of blew up when I read this because he's making a direct connection between both of these magics. You've got the whites up north that are animated by this ice magic, and you've got the Lord of the Light kind of style whites like Jon and Beric and Lady Stoneheart that are animated by fire.
Yeah.
Which kind of, like, there's also, like, one of the things I've been debating is whether there's this duality to the religion of Westeros, whether, you know, you've got, like, a good god and an evil god, or they different sides of the same coin, and like the Lord of the Light does a lot of sacrificing and the others have a lot of like, you know, blood magic and they sacrifice babies to make their, like, I just thought that was a really interesting concept. The fact that it does seem that the Mountain might be one of these kind of white styles, and Joe Q's email had me thinking those directions.
Yeah, I guess it would be sort of in opposition to the whites as we know them, right? The ice whites,
right?
If you want to call them that. I don't. It's interesting that you say that the Qyburn kind of trained under this master Marwyn, because this Archmaester Marwyn, because then you could see, okay, maybe he learned something about the ice magic, the children of the forest, and how they created them,
right.
And I could start to see that. But when you have George Martin saying he's the fire version of this, then that's where it confuses.
He didn't say that the Mountain was the fire version.
It's animated by the fire, yeah.
Well, but he was talking about Beric Dondarrion.
I thought he was talking about all of them.
Well, that's maybe my speculation. I'm saying anyone that's brought back from the dead must be, like I guess I'm I was before this interview. I was kind of open to the idea that there might be many ways to bring back someone from the dead.
Okay.
Also, that's other, I guess, another thing you could consider about Dany. Like, maybe Dany did perish in a fire, but also was somehow brought back by the fire magic. She's not fireproof, literally. Now, in the show, obviously, they've decided to make her fireproof. But I wonder if that was something when George was saying, no, this is a one-time magical event, that there was something more to that. That literally changed. Like, maybe Dany did die, and she changed in a more important way than we know.
Could be.
Although she doesn't seem like a white in any other way. Of course, neither does John.
That's the thing. When people say, oh, it drained John, I'm like, what the fuck? Yeah. Show me the representation of that on the screen because I can't tell.
And that could be another one of these simplifications that the show's doing, that the books will dwell more on
right,
the torment of John. Or maybe John's special that he doesn't apply to him because he's the blending of ice and fire. Like, who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what kind of theory crafting comes out of this interview with the Time magazine because there's a lot of new, exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Mike C., all this time we as readers and viewers keep asking how the Night King will tear down the wall, yet we ignore the fact that there's a land bridge on the western edge of the wall. It's called the Bridge of Skulls, and wildlings have used it to sneak south of the wall for thousands of years without climbing. While it's not flush against the sea, as is the wall by the East Watch by the sea, it's near the mountains, and the western tip of the wall stops at a gorge that flows into the sea. The Shadow Tower could serve as the castle in the Hound's vision. The Hound has a vision of a mountain that looks like an arrowhead. Maybe this is actually a giant wight in his vision, or something that's not part of the landscape, but mountains are in the west, not the east. I'm also skeptical that John and the Brotherhood seem confident that the Night King is marching on East Watch. I think we're being misled by the writers. Your thoughts? I don't know how I feel about the writers misleading us this much.
Yeah.
Like, you've got John saying, here's Hardhome, and if you look on the map, the next lot, like, if they just keep marching on the edge, they would have to literally go all the way across country to the other side. And, you know, that's where I guess the jetpacking starts to come in.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, I don't know exactly how long it takes, but John would.
Yeah.
And if they're at this east, if Tormund gets up at East Watch and there's no whites and there's no whites, is he's just going to be like, oh, we're still waiting? Or I think that the writers have to give us a little bit more information that maybe something is afoot before I would buy it. Because otherwise, you know, they're just feeding us just deliberate misinformation with no ability to tell.
Yeah, I'm mostly with you there. I think the one thing that I would add to it is John is making an assumption here.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of characters have made a lot of assumptions. Famously, Ned made mm-hmm. some assumptions about loyalty and got his head chopped for it. So it could just be that John makes the wrong assumption about where the White Walkers are headed. And that because that's the thing about the wall, right? Like, you go castle to castle on the wall here and you can't really see what's going on at the other castles, right? They're pretty right. far apart. So you head to East Watch and you say, well, there's nobody here yet, but how long do you wait? And by that time, could they have skipped one castle? And now they're at the second castle closest, and mm-hmm. now they're busting through the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe. But I'm with you. I think if they're going to do that, they need to kind of do some sort of buildup that tells us, hey, the walkers aren't headed to the place we think or that John thinks they're headed.
Because that's the other thing to consider, and this is just a Medicans conversation, is there's a very small army that can do something to oppose these the forces. And
right.
If they completely outflank them a half a country away,
uh-huh.
like that's game, like that's like there's not enough room for a margin for error for that to happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, it's really hard to foresee where they're going with some of this stuff, but
Other castle with the Hound, maybe the Beric and the Hound and his crew are going to head up to another castle
mm-hmm.
On the wall where the walkers are headed.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they could be the force, depending on how much power Beric has with his flaming sword and all that stuff. But I don't know.
All right. Sarah H., I've been trying to think of a reason that any of the books about the Long Night, White Walkers, or Dragonglass would be in the restricted section at the library at the Citadel. When I thought of what the maester who was performing the autopsy said to Sam about them being the memory of the Seven Kingdoms, why would something like that need to be kept hidden when there are millions of other books not? Do you think it's possible that they know about the White Walkers and why they come? I have a theory that the maesters are somehow complicit in their rising and know way more than they let on. So it's the restricted section, but it's restricted to maesters.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's forbidden knowledge, like only the archmaester can see it. It's more like these are texts that for whatever reason we don't want the unwashed masses getting in there and getting their hands on.
We don't want the guy cleaning out the chamber pots
right.
to get his hands on all the info yet.
It could be that these are rare texts from old Valeria that like they literally don't have copies of and they're just that much more afraid of them being stolen. Because
yeah.
it doesn't seem like the security is exactly state of the art.
No.
Like you palm a set of keys and you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the other hand, there is some solid theory crafting that the Maesters have been on a centuries-long effort to stamp out things that cannot be explained by secular science, like that they are they plotted to stifle the dragons and kill them off, that they've suppressed research into mysticism, and they've even though that they, if they're the memory of the world, they should know that some of this stuff is real, they've suppressed that knowledge and the teaching of it and the learning of it and the passing it on. So you might be onto something there. It's just, I don't, you know, and as far as them being complicit to the rising of it, like, last time the White Walkers, sometimes I think that people watching the show don't appreciate that this isn't like every 100 years kind of thing. Like, the last time the White Walkers walked was thousands and thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
Before, you know, the Citadel was even formed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that they, now, are they in league with them now? I don't know. I don't know how, because I don't think the Maesters are evil. I think they're just trying to do what's right by, you know, the realm. Like, I think that they think suppressing the superstition and this unnatural shit is the way for mankind to move forward. I think if they were in league with the White Walkers, that would be a little bit overstepping their bounds. Like, yeah. What do they get? Like, what do they get out of that?
When Westeros is conquered by the frozen demons, I don't know.
Yeah, like, do they want to take over Westeros? Do they want to rule? I mean, they already kind of do. Like, they have,
right?
They have trusted advisors in every major castle and every major lordship and the king. And they kind of are the power behind the power already.
They're sort of the Catholic Church of Westeros without the spiritual side, right?
Yeah. They're like the, you know, the Republican National Committee and Democratic National Committee together. They're just like the ones pulling the strings in the background. So I don't know. I don't know about them being complicit. And I don't see it as suspicious, I guess, as you do, that they, you know, when in a country where the vast majority of people can't read, that they keep this, there's a special section of the library where the really valuable, weird stuff they keep to themselves. I don't know. Rob H., I just had a thought. Could it be that the priceless gift Euron secures for Cersei is a dragon's head? Or what if some sort of sea monster, since this is her house crest, that could kill one of the dragons? Doesn't he have some sort of horn that we don't know about the use of yet?
Yeah, so I brought up the horn.
There's this horn in the book's Dragonbinder that Euron claims he got in his travels into Old Valyria, that he has one of his men blow it, and it makes us Aeron Damphair, who's the high priest of...
Wait, what's his name?
Aeron Damphair.
Damphair.
And a lot of people think it's actually Damphir, but it's actually Damphair. Think about it. Think about it. But anyway, he describes, he's the younger brother of Balon Greyjoy, who became the priest of the Drowned God, the high priest of the Drowned God. He describes it as the sound of a horn from hell. And as the guy blows it, the horn starts glowing red, and you can see these old Valyrian runes start glowing on it.
Shit.
And Euron says that this is some way to, like, magically bind dragons to your will, and he's going to use it to tame Dany's dragons and force her to marry him. But none of this shit is in the show at all.
Right, right.
And my question is, with 12 episodes to go, I use you as my barometer of the guy who's, like, not a big fantasy person, who likes the stories. How would you feel about a magic dragon-controlling horn coming up on the 11th hour of the show?
Well, here's the thing. How do I feel about a guy who walks into a throne room looking to make a deal and doesn't bring the fucking dealmaker with him? Like,
right.
Where are you keeping this thing? Is it in a safe deposit box at Chase?
You're like, right. That would have been the perfect opportunity to get the horn out, and because you could introduce it.
Not all be back once I get my magic horn.
Right.
No, bring the horn with you, man.
Yeah.
So I don't think so. I don't think that's going to be a part of it. I don't, like you said, I don't think there's enough time, and I think if they were going to introduce it, now's the time, and they didn't.
Yeah. Because every episode that goes by, it's like, you know, it's like if you're still looking for Lady Stoneheart, are you still going to be looking for Lady Stoneheart in the fifth episode of season 8?
What if he thinks he can actually bring her a dragon? Like, he's got this horn in his back pocket. He's going to bring her an actual dragon. Just the horn.
Like I said,
I think it's
just possible to introduce this horn and not have people rolling their eyes and slapping their foreheads. But you're really getting shaky on the tightrope.
Another couple episodes.
And because I've always said that the more magical things they introduce, that have yet to be explained, mm-hmm. the harder it's going to be for people to swallow and to be engaged in the story. Because if anything can happen, then what the hell? Like, yeah. why speculate about anything if some deus ex machina, yep. Hornus ex machina, is going to come out and, you know, control a dragon that you didn't know that was possible?
Right.
Like, what the hell?
Need some time to set it up.
So, Michael C., do you know, or do you think that the show is roughly in Dream of Spring territory, or are we still sort of loosely in what might be covered by the Winds of Winter? Or does any of what George intends even matter at this point? Well, that's a great question. I feel like we're probably still in the Winds of Winter territory because, I mean, we just got done with the Battle of the Bastards. That happened late last season, and that feels like that's going to be one of the first things that happens in Winds. So I would say that we're probably – but the problem is what's going to be, I guess, the climax, but one of the things in the last few books that George put out is there's not really a climax. I guess John getting stabbed to death is a cliffhanger climax. It's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
But, you know, it hasn't, like, built into some thing. They're just like you're in the middle of the story. So it's going to be real hard to say, like, oh, maybe in retrospect you can be like, oh, well, that's the end of Winds and here's the Dream of Spring. But even the books of that seem more like that's something that George came up with. But a whole book about the Dream of Spring, that seems like that's a very hopeful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's referring to how the book ends. I don't know. It's impossible to tell. It's impossible to tell. Now, the other thing is I know that the Double D's have talked about there's these few bullet points that were jaw-dropping when they read them. Mm-hmm. And, like, one of them was the death of Hodor. Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple points that we know that they're going to try to hit exactly as George gave them to him. But those are fewer and far between at this point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I think. It's going to be hard to tell when you actually get, you know, stop becoming Winds and it becomes Dream. I guess when... My gut would say that when we dispense with whatever the battle between the mortal people for realms of men and we actually join the battle against others, that will be definitively Dream of Spring territory.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin B., do you think we'll see a dragon die under the right circumstances north of the wall where a dragon will become a white controlled by the Night King? We've seen enough non-human whites that it seems possible. Unless the dragon's internal heat or fire make it impossible, I, for one, am hoping this happens.
Yeah, I don't see necessarily why it couldn't happen.
Yeah, and there's been a whole lot of, like, speculation about ice dragons.
Yeah.
You know, there is a semi-canon reference of those in, like, a children's book that George wrote a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I think there's been some references to those in, like, maybe some of the tales that old Nan... there's been a lot of, like, weird tinfoil theories about an ice dragon being buried in the wall or an ice dragon being buried underneath Winterfell. There was a sick fan-made poster of the Night King riding an ice dragon that people were trying to pawn off as an official HBO thing that turned out to be not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it would be cool, and it would be... It'd be a way to... Because, like, I guess the way I see it now is the White's main weakness is fire. And we've got an army armed with dragons.
Yeah.
So, like, you just like a single lantern can light one of these guys up. A torch can light one of these guys up like crazy. Like, what would a dragon, like, what would a dragon from something the size of Drogon do?
Right.
And if they neutralize that with a dragon of their own, that would kind of, I think it would really put the audience back on their heels. Like, oh, shit, now what?
Yeah.
But
and it would be... pretty fucking awesome to see a dragon battle, like a skybound dragon battle.
And you think about the White Walkers who've been around for thousands and thousands of years, like they maybe they have a long dead dragon. They don't need one of Dany's. They're just going to have their own ice dragons.
Could be.
It's one of those things where it's like just like the horn, if you pounce that on people too late in the game, it's going to still seem like, well, what the hell?
Yeah.
You know? Like I keep thinking, like, when the eagles saved the day at the end of Lord of the Rings. Imagine if you had never seen those eagles before. If they hadn't, you know, rescued Gandalf, if they hadn't been established in the Hobbit. Like, if they just, like, oh, shit, we have giant eagles that can destroy the fell beasts that the Nazgul ride? Like, what the hell? You gotta at least hint that you've got them before you break them out on the battlefield.
Yep.
David C., I wasn't sure whether the dragonglass candles have been mentioned in the show so far. They have not. But if you read the text on the page opposite of the page of the cat's paw dagger, so he's talking about the Valerian book that Sam's going through. It talks about dragonglass candles being lit with magic and allowing the user to see across mountains, seas, and deserts, and also to speak to each other. What? Do you think glass candles will be making an appearance this season, or is it just another nod to the readers? You're gonna have a theme to my responses, but I feel like, again, at this stage in the game, introducing like a Palantir-style mystical way to communicate over vast distances will feel a bit like a cheat.
Maybe. I mean, they've done enough to establish dragonglass as a thing. Mm-hmm. If Sam can discover like more of its properties,
yeah,
I might be okay with
it. The fact that you've got this obsidian material that's got a mystical connection to dragons and it can be fashioned in other ways, you're right. That's more of a, here is something we've already introduced as a building block and here's another way it can be configured together.
Just like if, you know, it turns out to have the magical healing properties for grayscale.
Right.
Like, I could be okay with it because I know dragon glass is kind of mysterious, but it's a thing already.
Right.
So maybe Sam could learn more about it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the roles I've always thought was that Bran could plausibly play would be like a coordinator.
Right.
Because he can use the weirwood to communicate through dreams or maybe through visions and like help coordinate the you know, disparate forces of men. Mm-hmm. And if they have a candle where they can just, you know, keep in touch that way.
What do they need Bran for?
Right. But maybe they got other bigger uses for Bran and this is going to be a way to... But they already have. They also have ravens. Like, why wouldn't ravens work?
Right.
They freeze to death. They're
maybe,
too slow.
Yeah.
Like, you have to have instant.
The ice dragons keep eating them. I don't know.
All right. So, I don't know. I don't know. It definitely could be a nod to the book readers because we're the ones that we freeze framing these pictures and poring over them. So
yeah.
Connor F., what if the reason the Hound is able to see the visions in the flame isn't just due to some shred of potential belief in this red god? Melisandre once said that death by fire is a pure death, but what about what happens to Sandor Clegane as a pup? What if that horrific moment in his life where Gregor forced his head down into the flames was a fated baptism by fire, and now with all the transformation the Hound has undergone as well as the new lease on life, what if now we can finally have a better grasp on the red god? That's an interesting theory. What do you think of it?
I mean, what's the theory there?
That Sandor's connection to fire, even though he's afraid of it, he's been literally baptized in the fire because his brother held his face into a brazier and it half melted off.
Mm-hmm.
And that connection to fire is what allows him to see the messages in the flames.
Oh, okay.
Because the other way to look at this is, I believe Melisandre guided Stannis to see things in the flames, too. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not like Sandor's just out camping alone and the Red God started speaking to him. He had a priest of the Red God guide him on this, you know, vision. So,
Something I thought about, I was thinking about it a little bit after the podcast we recorded on Tuesday. I wonder if it wasn't Thoros just kind of showing him things. Now, mm-hmm. Beric looked pretty surprised by it, but Thoros did not. So I just wonder if Thoros is showing him things or if he's seeing things because he's chosen by the Red God or special somehow or whatever. I don't know.
Plus,
the baptism by fire thing, he has a connection to fire, certainly.
Right.
But it's a little more dubious than like being a Targaryen.
And it also might just be thematic, you know, that he's conquered his fear and that, you know, the thing that he's been afraid of his whole life is now the thing that he kind of unites under the banner of, like, although I guess he wouldn't use a banner since it's the brotherhood of that banners.
Traitor.
But I don't know. I like it, but I also don't think it's strictly necessary now that I thought about it because he did have, the other thing is that, Melisandre is obviously manipulating Stannis, or at least the Red God is manipulating her, and they were seeing things that weren't strictly true.
Right.
We also know that both Melisandre and Thoros have confessed to using tricks and parlor magic to kind of, you know, pull off their priestly duties before the Red God started no shit working. Mm-hmm. So there's also the idea that maybe they're trying to manipulate Sandor to some end. I don't think so, because I feel like that, you know, Thoros and Beric and those, they are good guys, but that's another possibility. Before we get any further, today's sponsor is Audible, and Audible's been with the podcast for a long, long time. I think they might be the first, if not one of the first sponsors. So yeah. We owe them a lot. And you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at audible.com/GOT. That's an exclusive code for listeners of our podcast. I got a clear recommendation for you because I've been a longtime Audible member. Mm-hmm. The entire library of George R. R. Martin is on Audible, and it's a great way to re-experience it. Or if you're one of those adventuresome book show-watching fans that haven't gotten to the books, because I know so that's a lot of commitment. What's awesome about Audible is it allows you to use your time more wisely. If you got a long commute, obviously you've got something that you're trying to avoid doing because you're a podcast fan. You're trying to avoid a commute. You're trying to avoid boring chores. You're trying to avoid time stuck in your own head. Don't need any of that nonsense. You can get the entire Song of Ice and Fire series read to you by Roy Deutres, who is an award-winning audiobook narrator. He's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah.
His one flaw is he's a little slow for me, but you know what's cool about the Audible app that's available for every smartphone in his existence? You can control the playback speed. Like, yeah. I like to get Ray stepping to about 1.1, 1.15, and right. It really gets a sense of urgency into him.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, these books are pretty long, so you know, if you want to check out, you get a book every month. You get a credit for mm-hmm. a book every month, so when they're at 34 hours, it's going to be about a month before you get through it, probably. Right. So every month, you got a new Game of Thrones book where they're waiting for you.
And when I was doing the Game of Thrones series, like I prefer to read on my Kindle. But what's awesome is with the Audible supporting the WhisperSync technology, I could go to bed at night, read until my eyes crossed, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, plug my phone into my car for my commute, and Roy's there reading right where I left off, and it just keeps on going. It's a great way to rapidly infuse the series. Mm-hmm. It's a great company. Again, you can get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial today by signing up at audible.com/GOT. Daniel has a question for me. Can you actually tell me where the Prince That Was Promised or the Azor Ahai legend even exists? I've read the books as well, and though my memory is hazy in the details, I don't actually remember that it exists anywhere concrete. In other words, I know it's referred to in the book what it is that's being referred to. It seems to me that some of the characters in the book, and by extension the fans themselves, have been sloppy and conflated several things that don't necessarily fit together or exist at all. Hmm. There was Azor Ahai, the historical character, but where does this notion come from that he's destined to return? And similarly, where does the legend of the so-called Prince That Was Promised actually come from? And assuming both of the previous questions have an answer, what is the justification for conflating the two legends? I don't have great answers for you because these prophecies are all kind of lumped together. You're right. And like, you're also leaving out the Last Hero legend, which is more of a northern legend about the one of the first men. He sets off with 12 companions to try to find the Children of the Forest during the long... We're talking about a winter that's lasted a generation. And they try to go to find the Children of the Forest to offer an alliance with them to beat back the Dawn. And the Last Hero, fitting to his name, loses all of his 12 companions along the way, finally meets up the Children of the Forest, forges a pact with them, and they together somehow beat back the White Walkers and banish them to the lands of Always Winter. So there's one. There's also the Prince That Was Promised, which, as far as I can tell, is something that Rhaegar Targaryen, because he loved literature and reading, discovered himself at reading in the Targaryen libraries. Hmm. And he came out one day from the library saying, apparently I have to be a warrior to fulfill this prophecy, and then started studying martial skills and became obsessed with fulfilling the prince that was the promised. So that's like some kind of old Valyrian legend. And then Azor Ahai is something that comes out from that's something the priest of R'hllor push, and they're from kind of the lands of Ashai. But I think what they're getting at is this idea of this shared mythology. Like a lot of the people that think about theologian history, they notice that lots of cultures worldwide have like this monomyth about the flood.
Yeah.
And you can say that's because literally 6,000 some years ago, there was a flood, mm-hmm. and Noah and his family saved, and then that story spread across the whole earth. when those families, you know, migrated around. Or you could say, like, at some point when mankind, like eons in mankind's history, there was a localized flood back in Mesopotamia or in Africa that was so impactful and so destructive that it became woven to, like, on all of our mythical memories.
Right.
So you've got, you know, the voyage of So it's not what I'm getting at is there's the Noah's Ark story, and then there's like the Epic of Gilgamesh that talks about this. It's a lot the same, and there's an Asian influence one. There's these stories all over the globe, mm-hmm. because it's this cataclysmic event. And what I think George is hinting at is if the Long Night actually happened, there's something like the Long, like what the Archmaester was saying. Like, I believe, because there's so many of these unconnected myths that all tell the same story, that this is a true story, that something actually happened in humans' ancient memory. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they're going for, that these are all separate myths from separate cultures, but they're talking about the one event, the Long Night, that actually happened.
Right.
And that's also the reason I think a lot of people conflate them, is because even Melisandre will, like, refer to Azor Ahai and the prince that was promised kind of interchangeably herself.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe she understands it the same way you do, perhaps?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Or it could be George got a little sloppy, or it could be that she's relating the story to in terms that people would be familiar with. Like, you know, there's lots of different reasons. But as far as where they come from, the Long Night seems like it's a first man myth. The Azor Ahai seems like it's something from Ashai, and the prince was promised some kind of Valerian deal. So
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role, and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Moving on to Leslie L. Because the Iron Throne is made up of swords that Aegon took when he conquered the Seven Kingdoms, do you think it contains Valyrian steel and will have to be melted down to create weapons to fight the Night's King? No.
It's swords he took when he conquered the land?
Yeah, so
it wouldn't be Targaryen swords, right?
Well, I mean, people had because Valyrian, you know, it's not
Valyrians
like,
are not Targaryens, sure. Yeah,
well, the Targaryens are Valyrians.
They are,
Valyrians
but not
Targaryens.
Yeah, yeah, the other way.
And you know, it was not. People had Valyrian steel because there was trade over the Narrow Sea. Mm-hmm. They were rare and they're expensive, but they weren't unknown before Aegon came over. Now, the Targaryens only had two ancestral Valyrian steel blades, Blackfyre and the Dark Sister. So I would think that if Aegon had, like if these lords are laying their swords at his feet, he would be like, oh, well, that's a Valyrian one. Yoink, I'm going to keep this. Like, why would he melt that down into the throne?
Right.
The other thing is Valyrian steel looks differently. Like, it's got that rippled Damascus-style steel kind of finish. So, like,
okay.
People would be remark like, oh, look, there's the Valyrian sword that's in the Iron Throne. Now, let's get to theory crafting. Because we don't know how Valyrian steel is made, but there's a lot of popular theories that it's magical in nature, and dragons are magical in nature, and that we also have sources that say that the Valyrians use dragon fire in the construction of their palaces and stuff.
Right.
That some people think that Valyrian steel could be just, you know, steel that's been treated with dragon fire.
Kissed by the dragon's fire, yeah.
Which case, maybe all the swords in the... But the thing is like it doesn't match the rippled effect. Like, I don't think a
the
dragon...
The look of it?
Yeah, I don't think a dragon can literally just melt steel and boom, it's Valyrian.
Okay.
I don't subscribe, because there is a theory that's like, oh, they'll have to melt down the Iron Throne and make a shit ton of Valyrian swords because it's all been kissed by dragon fire, as you said. I don't subscribe to that theory. But it's a popular one.
Yeah. Yeah. It has a certain appeal,
right.
I think. The idea that maybe Dany might break the wheel by melting the throne that was melted to make it and turning them into swords. I don't know.
It
That'd
could
be cool.
True another way. Like, it's not Valyrian steel now, but they, you know, Dany will set, like, it will melt down the Iron Throne and do the correct process to make them all Valyrian steel. But, like, it's not like
you don't need the throne steel. Yeah, you got plenty of steel.
Yeah, it's not like there's a shortage of steel in the land.
No.
I don't know. I never found those compelling, but that's how I understand kind of the state of where the theory crafts are at. Doug L. While the show presents many different religions, the deity called R'hllor has made his presence known by actively participating in show events, be it raising the dead, birthing shadow babies, or revealing visions. There can be no doubt that some supernatural entity or entities has an agenda of some kind being implemented. So let's take that first. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I do.
Well, the only thing I would say is the entity part, which...
Okay, which, that's fair. Force.
Yes.
Some
power.
I don't even know if I would call it a being.
Yeah,
you know?
That's the thing. Like, I hesitate to describe it having a will of its own.
Mm-hmm.
But
it certainly has an influence.
It's certainly a force that can be harnessed and used to do things that we can't understand.
Yeah.
With that minor quibble, Doug L. continues, so the question I pose to you is, how critical will it be that the characters and or viewers become fully aware of the true nature of the supernatural forces at work here? I suspect that this will be key to defeating the Walkers, but it's also possible that the story will resolve without some of these mysteries being fully explored. To what extent do you think these questions need answering?
I don't see a huge need for it, honestly. Like, if you can defeat the White Walkers through Dragon Glass or Valyrian Steel or whatever by killing the heads and... you know, killing all the actual White Walkers themselves, you might not need to explain much of it at all.
Yeah, I mean, like, how vital is it to the great religions of the world that they understand the true nature of God? Because most religious scholars would say God is kind of ineffable.
Mm-hmm.
At least the Western, you know, is the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition of God. So,
sure.
And they function just fine with, you know, him being kind of difficult to understand or his reasoning being above us. So I guess I don't know why that the mystical system or the gods or the, you know, who's the true God, do we need to know that? Because, again, this seems like a human story.
It does.
That has all these trappings onto it. So, like, having that be some central mystery that has to be unraveled would then suddenly wrest control from the human side to the mystical. Which I'm not saying that George might not do. I'm just saying that I don't think that's where he's getting at. So I would
I just don't see the scene where we zoom out from Planetos or whatever it's called, and we get the like I am God scene, yeah. right? Like we're not going to get introduced to the power right. controlling everything. So.
Right.
I mean, short of that, I don't know how much more they need to do.
I mean, we need to know the mechanical workings out of this stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like,
I want to know that when we defeat the White Walkers, they're gone. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to think, oh, Winter's just coming back again in another 1,000 years or whatever.
I'm fine with that. Like, if they if they staved it off for another cycle.
Yeah.
And then this question is like, will they remember?
Will they
are we
ever...
doomed to forget this? Like, you know. That would be kind of cool, but I do think that you should understand that they've been defeated, to what extent they've been defeated, and how they were defeated.
Okay. Like that threat is at bay for now.
Right, right.
At least.
And it shouldn't be like some Deus Ex Machina kind of thing.
Right.
Emma D says, I was listening to your feedbacks podcast on season 7, episode 1, where you were contemplating what the point of finding a cure for Ser Jorah's grayscale would be.
Yeah.
And I thought you were missing an obvious possibility. Hmm. Perhaps a cure from grayscale will make it possible for either Dany or Jon's forces, or both together, to get past all the grayscaley people outside of Valyria and find the method for creating Valyrian steel. Stashes of dragonglass or all the ancient records that were lost during the Doom of Valyria. It's possible that the Valyrians were the force who originally defeated the White Walkers, and that is why they adorned their castles with dragonglass and created weapons such as Valyrian steel that could defeat both humans and the undead. When Tyrion and Jorah passed by the Smoking Sea, they were attacked by people infected by grayscale, so it's logical to conclude that the cure to the grayscale may make it possible to get back and explore or exploit the ruins of Valyria.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so.
The only reason I would say no is because, again, time. Like, you've got to cure Jorah,
right.
then you got to get Jorah the Explorer to go and mount up an expedition,
yeah.
find something of value, bring it back in time to win the day.
And we've already found it, right? It's Dragonglass.
It's Dragonglass.
And we know where it is. We know how to get it. We know how to make it into weapons. Let's do that.
But, you know, could you make Valyrian steel armor? Could you, like, I mean, finding the secret to Valyrian, or this could be another way to bring in some kind of magical horn deal.
Okay, that, like it's like, in Valyria?
Yeah, but again, there just doesn't seem like there's enough time to do all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right, that is, like, if this all went down last season, I'd be like, yeah, Jorah the Explorer, part two. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, Emma.
Maybe, I mean, it's possible.
It's like Dunkirk, I hear the ticking of the clock in every one of these scenes.
But clearly they want to do something with it, right? So,
true.
You know, like, Jorah's still hanging around, Jorah's still looking for the cure.
Right.
His grayscale is still a factor because they show it. So
yeah,
what are they going to do with it?
I can't,
something.
I read so much stuff and I only write down stuff that I find, but I remember a lot of it, but then I can't give proper attribution to the source, so it sucks. but there's this one person, maybe it was on Vox, but they were spitballing ideas based off this Martin interview in Time. And they had this idea that maybe these dragon scale people are like, the undead aren't like the living army equivalent of the whites,
uh-huh.
that they can somehow, like, if they can, like, find a way to, so you could essentially go over to old Valyria and cure these guys and bring them over as additional manpower. But I don't
think they need it.
Yeah. And like, also, I mean, just, yeah, like, yeah.
You got dragons, you got the Unsullied, you got armies in Westeros,
The only thing that theory's got going for is there's a nice symmetry that the evil guys are using these, you know, monstrous creatures, and then the good guys might be too, but then,
maybe.
I don't know.
I mean, it's not impossible, but...
Right. But that's a good theory there. Eric V.A., not sure if this has been asked yet, but what are the chances that Bran wargs into one of Dany's dragons? Seems that he is able to warg into an undead giant. If he's able to warg into an undead giant, a dragon wouldn't be out of the question. Does this seem plausible or completely out of the question?
Yeah, no, I think it's totally plausible.
Yeah, I think that's might be one of the things that that helps them. Like, and you know, there's this the dragon must have three heads, which is another Rhaegar classic that he just pulls out of his ass, and we just like take it for, you know, maybe Rhaegar's just crazy. Rhaegar just was chugging the nightshade shit that the warlocks were drinking,
yeah.
and just, you know, he was just tripping on acid, and all this stuff is not even true. But you know, people for a long time were trying to figure out, well, who are the heads of the dragon? You know, Danny's got to be one of them. Maybe Jon. Maybe Tyrion will ride with some kind of crazy modified saddle of his own design. Or maybe, you know, Bran's got to, like, he wants to be able to fly. Well, what's cooler than flying as a dragon?
Right.
That's a very popular theory that hasn't been discussed much because I think all those things have been beaten into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess now that Danny, because that's the other thing, is that this was, I think, more popular when Danny didn't have control over dragons, but it seems like she's got them completely eating out of her hand.
Yeah.
Which probably is a bigger deal in the books, but in the show, it's just, she just up and mounted Drogon, and they're cool.
Yeah.
And by extension, since Drogon's the biggest, baddest of the dragons, she's cool with all the dragons now.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing, bringing back this three-headed dragons, is they also establish a relationship between Tyrion and the dragons.
Right.
Which I think is interesting. So I haven't given up hope in the dragon with three heads theory yet.
Yeah.
Because even if, you know, I can't think of any examples where Targaryens would just use dragons as terror shock troops. Like, they always had riders. They always had a human to direct their attention and their fire. Dany is still just one person.
Uh-huh.
So it seems like she could benefit from having two other riders, and Bran warging it would be the best possible type of rider, I would think.
Has anybody considered Euron?
Oh boy, you are stealing my thunder, buddy.
Oh, am I?
About to get to the Volded section.
Yeah.
We got the Volancar theories, and then we got the Euron stuff.
Okay. So, I'll save it then.
Let's go, Aeron P. When talking about who gets Carhold in the last Hearth, I find it interesting that they didn't mention the Dreadfort. Now that House Bolton is completely extinct, why not find a Bannerman or Bannerwoman to man the Dreadfort?
I think that in that moment they were concerned with the closest of the castles,
but
the ones in most direct fire, right?
Yeah, but it's like arbitrary because the Dreadfort's the next one. And
right, how many along the way
thing,
do you want to man?
When he sent this in, and Aeron sent this in, I'm like, you know, the other thing is this would be a way for Jon and Sansa to both be right. Like, let's keep the old families in control of their old houses, but, you know, you'd have this ridiculous moment where, like, Jon calls forth, Tyrion Bolton.
Uh-huh.
Like the 6-year-old Bolton nephew of Roose that we've never met before. It has him. But we all hate the Boltons. We think the Boltons are all, you know, they're not going to have a warm and fuzzy Lannister moment with Arya. But like he could have been like, okay, we'll give the Dreadfort to someone that deserves it and we'll keep the Umbers and Karstarks in control of the last Hearth. That does bug me because he goes on and says, like, it follows a pattern where the show just kind of neglects. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, Dragonstone, Stannis left, no one owns it. You know, what happens to River Run? What happens to Castle Rock? What's going on at Sunspear or Highgarden or any of these castles where everyone's dead, no one's in control? It's like, well, fuck it, whatever.
Well, I mean, that's kind of, look at the English countryside, littered with castles that don't have, like, are just in total disarray, don't have anybody manning
because
them.
Because the landed gentry collapsed in the last 100 years, man.
Right, but my point is, like, when does that happen?
When they can't afford to keep them anymore.
I feel like that's starting
to
happen in Westeros. Like,
you're not, and that's the other reason why I really like the whole constitutional monarchy, democracy thing, is because it does seem like this is a period of time where the landed gentry could collapse.
Yeah.
Because the richest family in the realm is bankrupt.
The Tyrells are the only thing keeping them in business,
they
right?
They fought bitter battles. And the Tyrell line, as far as we know, is dead.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's Lady, unless Lady Olenna can pump out another one.
I doubt it.
Done.
I seriously doubt it. So, unless she's way younger than I think under all that garmentation.
She's glamored to look old.
Maybe so.
She's one of Westeros' famed MILFs.
Yeah.
The Sand MILFs. The flower, I guess it'd be the flower mills.
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, how much time do you want the show to catch us up on current events, and how much do you want to stay focused on Danny and John? It's a trade-off.
I do think the point stands, like, they could have had a moment where he compromises here, or not even compromises, but gives Sansa a little bit of what she wants, which is to reward the people who helped him.
Right.
And that seems like a perfect opportunity.
Because the Dreadfort's obviously up for grabs.
Right.
All right, let's talk some about. Let's do some lightning.
And now
round.
The twins, like give somebody the twins,
right? Yeah, like who's going to own the twins? And that twins are completely vacant. Let's do a lightning round on Valonqar theories. Alexander W. What if Arya assassinates Jaime, acquires his face, and then kills Cersei? This seems like a convenient way for Arya to get close to Cersei. It also allows Jaime to be the Valonqar in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And also means that Jaime and Cersei will die around the same time.
I like it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
I read this and I'm like, this seems like a prophecy dodge. This seems like some Nostradamus shit, where, like, if given enough history, something around those times of this guy rambling will come true.
To me, it seems like a less obvious way to fulfill the prophecy. that the fans might not have seen coming.
Yeah, but and also there's also this...
They clearly do.
A lot of people like to point out that Valonqar is a Valyrian word, and that in Valyrian that gendered language is very fluid because the dragons are sexless, and you know the dragons are like the pinnacle of their culture. So like it could be little brother, but that's a kind of patriarchal way to look at it. Could easily be little sister.
Hmm.
So Arya with Jaime's face would be the ultimate fulfillment of that type of prophecy,
right?
But the other thing is like I don't like it narratively because it does seem like in my mind they built up the idea that Jaime's going to get fed up with her,
right.
The fact that she's been. You know, Cersei has been all about Cersei, and if you read her POV chapters, it's all about how upset she is because she wasn't allowed to lead because she wasn't born with a penis, which is a perfectly valid thing to get upset about.
Sure,
but I don't think that she's ever cared about Jaime the way that Jaime's cared about her, and she seems to be willing. In fact, she sees like Jaime as an extension of herself. Like to the extent that she waxes like romantic about him, it's like, you know, she sees him as the other half of her. And like when he's inside me, I feel complete. But it's not like she loves Jaime so much as she loves this other aspect of herself.
Weird.
So, but I do think that Jaime and all of his POV chapters, it's very obvious that he truly does love his sister.
Yeah. I think they've done a good job to set that up in the show as well.
Yes.
I've never felt that there's a truly, whatever the word is, mutual.
Right.
Love there. But I felt like it's more from Jaime's side.
Yeah, and I guess they did establish that Cersei was cheating with
Lancel.
With Lancel, but in the books that's a much more like she uses her seduction to get her way a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I just feel like that it seems dramatically appropriate that he'll betray her.
And you just never see a scene like he had with Edmure, right, in that tent.
Right.
Where he said, "Look, I will kill every last person in this castle to get back to Cersei if that's what I have to do, or every person in your family."
Right.
Cersei's never said that about Jaime.
Let's see. Now we're getting into the Euron stuff. Nick S. had a comment about the Dragonbinder horn that he speculated that could be the gift that we already talked about. And then Megan B. really kicks off the Euron discussion. "I'm a book reader who has been thinking about the Valonqar puzzle for a long time now. I know the Valonqar hasn't even mentioned in the TV show, but I feel like the double Ds know that the book readers are looking for it and will have the theory play some part in Cersei's TV demise." I agree with that. Like, they cannot introduce it, but have it still fulfill the prophecy that hasn't been spoken in this show. In fact, there's no way they can have Cersei be killed by someone else than how George wants her to be killed. Like, I feel like that's one way they can fuck things up royally.
Mm.
The obvious little brother character is Jaime and Tyrion, but after watching Euron Greyjoy in the season premiere, I had a couple of thoughts. Balon Greyjoy is the oldest sibling. Euron is his younger brother. Check. Valonqar is a word in the Valyrian language. Euron is a character with strong association to Valyria, both in the books and the show. He's sailed to that land and taken treasure from it. In the book preview chapter released by Gurm, Euron has a full suit of Valyrian armor.
Hmm.
Neither Jaime nor Tyrion has an association to Valyria. If Euron comes back to King's Landing with a good enough gift, Cersei's overconfident enough to bring Euron onto her team. We know from the season trailers that Jaime is going to leave King's Landing at some point to lead the army against Dany's forces. It's doubtful he would be in charge of the army if he killed Cersei beforehand, which implies that at some point, Jaime won't be around to watch Cersei's back. Euron's promised his people all of the Seven Kingdoms. He needs to fulfill his promise or he loses his support structure. Euron's an insane, murderous bastard. If he thinks he will get away with it, even for a moment, he'll absolutely try to kill Cersei and take the throne. Tinfoil, I think Euron is going to be the one who kills Cersei in the TV show. He's the younger brother. He has a connection with the Valyrian language. It seems like he will be in proximity to commit the crime, and he's crazy enough to do it. The way the show is going, I think it is likely that Cersei will agree to marry Euron, and Jaime will be heartbroken and leave town rather than stay for the wedding, at which point Euron murders Cersei, and Jaime tries to commit suicide by dragon, which explains kind of his insane charge towards what we presume is a dragon that we saw in the trailer. What do you think about all this? And also, I want to slip in one other piece of knowledge that was written in by countless people. Euron says that he wants to marry the most beautiful woman in the world. He does not say Cersei.
Right.
So he could, while Jaime's away, murder Cersei and intend to, you know, impress Danny with like, hey, let's just rule it as king. Now what Danny reacts to that on, that's a whole other level to the stuff. What do you think about this Euron Greyjoy theory?
That's interesting. I was gonna come at it from the Dragon Rider thing, but killing Cersei. I mean, things could line up that way. It's a compelling case as far as like Jaime being out of town when it happens.
Yeah, up until this last...
Because I think the judgment that Cersei is willing to partner with Euron if he brings back the right gift is spot on.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I read that scene.
Do you... I mean, up until last season, I thought the Greyjoys were just a dead plot line.
Yeah.
That they were going to be, you know, like, you know, Quentin Martell and like the Fagon stuff, that was going to be just stuff that the Double D's... streamlined. The fact that they brought him back and are making him a central character makes me think that he might be more vital to the way the story ends than I initially imagined.
Yeah, his ships are certainly vital. Whether the character himself will be super important going forward, I think it's still up in the air, but those ships are super important to Cersei. Mm.
All right. So this leads me to the thing I want to close on, which is like some Euron... tinfoil theory type stuff because in the off season and the off break I read all the preview chapters. I rubbed shoulders and elbows with a lot of theory crafters down at the Con of Thrones, and I got kind of like an education in kind of the state of the art theory crafting around Euron, and there's a lot of interesting parallels with Euron and Bloodraven and Bran, and I'm going to consider some of these from the books. A description of Bloodraven from the World of Ice and Fire, which is the encyclopedia kind of compendium.
Bloodraven, just for people who aren't sure what that term is.
Thank you. He's the three-eyed raven. He's the person who was
in the tree,
all up in the tree that Bran learned greenseeing from. It became common to refer to. So this is referring to Bloodraven when he was still a man. That was Brendan Rivers, one of the great bastards. It became common to refer to his thousand eyes in one, and men both high and low began to distrust their neighbor for fear of their being a spy in Bloodraven's employ. This is I'm making connections between Bloodraven and Euron here.
Okay.
Euron, as described by Victarion, Victarion says he looks unchanged. His hair was still as black as midnight sea. There's never a white cap to be seen. His face was still smooth and pale beneath his neat dark beard. A black leather patch covered Euron's left eye, but his right eye was blue as a summer sky. Huh. This showing that the reason that the three-eyed raven's called a thousand eyes in one is because he only has the one eye. He lost his eye in battle.
Okay.
And he says his smiling eye, thought Victarion, his crow's eye. And that's one of the... nicknames for Euron is Crow's Eye. And also the Blood Raven is called the Three-Eyed Raven. This is an encounter, the first encounter Bran has with the Three-Eyed Raven. Are you the Three-Eyed Crow? Bran heard himself say. A Three-Eyed Crow should have three eyes. He has only one, and that one is red. Bran could feel the eye staring at him, shining like a pool of blood in the torchlight. Where his other eye should have been, a thin white root grew from an empty socket down his cheek and into his neck. Then from the new preview chapter, from the Winds of Winter, the Forsaken, this is the sigil that Euron has chosen from himself. So it's from the sterns of the ships flew a flag the priest had never seen before, a red eye with a black pupil beneath an iron crown supported by two crows.
So and you can see that red eye on the
exactly the ship that pulls show, in. Yeah. So you see the connection between the three-eyed raven and the Euron continues. And here's something interesting. I want to learn magic, Bran told him. The crow promised that I would fly. Euron's recounting a story from his youth. It says Euron stood by the window drinking from a silver cup. He wore the sable cloak he took from Black Tide, his red leather eye patch, and nothing else. When I was a boy, I dreamt I could fly, he announced. When I woke, I couldn't, or so the maester said. But what if he lied? So there's some thin stuff here, because this is a theory that's in that like the books just stopped coming out to support. But Euron also has boasted of traveling to the dark lands of Ashai and has sailed through the Smoking Sea and has walked through the ruins of old Valyria. Like I said, his preview chapter reveals that he has a full suit of Valyrian steel armor, something that no one's seen for thousands of years. So there's a couple of main theories. One, that Euron was some sort of failed apprentice of the Three-Eyed Crow. And the evidence of that is that it seems like the Three-Eyed Roe approaches his candidates in dreams. Like, he started recruiting Bran by his dreams, promising he could fly. And Euron tells a story where he had this dream that ended up not going anywhere. Again, the only support for that is that single statement and the fact that the Blood Raven and Euron are connected through this, the fact that they have the one eye and the fact that they're, you know, a lot of their personal symbology is the same. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that Euron is kind of like gone around the globe and he drinks like immense quantities of the warlock's wine that makes him see visions. His lips are stained blue because he drinks them so much. He's like the warlocks of Karth. And he's learned all this dark magic and black magic. Another theory is that Euron is going to be like the Saruman to the Three-Eyed Crow's Sauron. There's a theory that the Three-Eyed Crow is actually not working for humanity, that he's eventually going to be proven a traitor, mm-hmm. and that Euron is kind of like the guy that's maneuvering things on his behalf. And there's the flip side of that theory.
That theory sounds odd to me because of their personalities.
Well,
but yeah.
Well, that's the thing, because the show Blood Raven is a lot cuddlier than the book Blood Raven. Because the book Blood Raven is literally a mummified corpse with roots growing out of his eyeballs.
Right.
He's forcing Bran to eat this crazy paste that might have human blood in it that a lot of people think is actually Jojen that's been liquefied and being fed to him as a human sacrifice.
Jesus.
So that's like, I think a lot of this is like more book theory. But the other flip side of that is that Euron is being used as a pawn to collect things that a hero might need to defeat the White Walkers, that he might need a horn to bind dragons so he can use their dragon fire. He might need a suit of Valyrian steel armor to protect himself, and that Euron is going around and getting these things, thinking that he's going for world domination, and he's actually going to have all these things taken from him and given him to the true true hero.
Seems more reasonable.
But here's the third theory that I like, because in this preview chapter to Forsaken, Euron's just ranting and raving about how he wants to kill all the gods and make himself one. And he forces his brother, Aeron Dampier, to drink this warlock's brew that causes him to trip balls. And he sees Euron sitting on the Iron Throne, and in all the spikes of the Iron Throne, there's like the drowned god is impaled. The seven gods from the Faith of the Seven is there. The old gods are impaled. All these gods that he doesn't even recognize are, and Euron is like this powerful thing that's gathered all this power to himself, and he's sacrificed thousands of blood sacrifices to increase his power, and that his study of black magic from around the world and the fact that he might have tutored under the Three-Eyed Raven has convinced him that he can become a god. And these theories kind of there's a couple of versions of that. One is that he's going to become the human face of the White Walkers, like a Locutus of Borg character.
Right.
That, you know, since the others are this, these White Walkers are these others that we can't relate to, that you need to put a human face to have them be a compelling villain, because Martin doesn't usually just have these like faceless, pure evil villains. Or the other thing is what Euron hopes is that he's actually going to overthrow the Night's King and become the leader.
That feels very much more Euron to me.
And you think of like this,
what I know of him.
Like maybe the true purpose of this Dragonhorn is to destroy their Night's King, and he's got a Valyrian steel armor, so they can't even touch him. Mm-hmm. And he's going to come, like there might be this shocking scene where Euron just kills the Night's King and takes over.
Yeah.
And becomes a white himself. And now we've got a human face that we can root against. And you know, these aren't just these runaway weapons of war that don't even remember. You know, because that's the thing. They've established the White Walkers as being these almost like runaway weapons of war that don't even have a purpose anymore. There's something the Children of Forest tried to kill the First Men with, and it went haywire.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, we've talked about this in podcasts before, that's not a very Martin kind of villain. It's not a villain with a lot of dimensions. It's essentially a Terminator, which can be a great villain, but not necessarily a great Martin villain.
Okay.
So what do you think of any? That's a lot to take in.
Yeah. So I feel like the ones that lean more toward ego and the search of godhood feel a lot more Euron to me. Mm. The way he's portrayed in the show.
Right.
He does not seem like an agent for good, in my opinion.
The real problem of the show is they've not then
maybe an unwitting agent for good, like if he's being used to collect these artifacts that can be used to fight the Night's King, sure. But I don't think his intention is to use them to protect Westeros.
Yeah, and the problem, so I buy these theories that Euron is more important to the plot than we think, because else why bring the Greyjoys back?
Right.
But there's a couple things I don't like. Number one, the preview chapter, The Forsaken, is the worst sort of Ramsay Bolton kind of torture porn that you'll ever see, and I kind of don't think the show needs more of that at this stage.
Okay.
The other thing is all this mystical stuff, all this, you know, him having his magic eye, all this him quaffing this vast quantities of the Warlock's brew, all this him having a Valyrian steel suit and having that, none of that is in the show.
That's true. Yeah.
Euron is just a warlord.
Maybe he comes back with like 15 gifts.
I mean, yeah.
Maybe he's got a Valyrian steel suit. Maybe
that starts falling afoul of my whole, like, they got to be careful about introducing new things, new super weapons, new abilities, new. And if that. But I wonder if there's like a more grounded, streamlined version of Euron just, you know, maybe he does conquer Cersei and then maybe Dany spurns him and then he learns about the others and he goes to make an alliance with them and the Night King just, you know, Lucutuses him.
Uh-huh.
So now he's the swagger. He's going to be the swaggery spokesperson that's talking smack to Jon across the battlefield with the Night King behind him. That seems maybe like a stronger possibility.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's hard to finalize a deal with that Night's King, though. You go to shake his hand, and you kind of get the deal that he offers, regardless of what it is.
He just marked me. What does this even mean? And he just hisses at you. Are we ever going to hear those guys talk?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because we know they were once men. Mm-hmm. They've got all the equipment for it.
Yep.
It's kind of weird that they haven't done anything besides slowly raise their arms and get into sword fights and gloat.
Yeah, I mean, they
communicate their languages entirely based in gloating. They have a gloating-based language.
Right.
Just the subtle nuances and body language.
Do they have an actual verbalized language? Because, like, if you look where they're recruiting from, it's babies, right? Like, these Craster's babies, potentially?
Yeah, but it's not like they
Would they like, once you become one of these White Walkers, do you need to verbally communicate?
Oh, maybe they have some.
Do you have some kind of psychic connection?
Right, because they can just go and intrude on Bran's vision. So maybe they do. Yeah, that's a good theory.
I don't know that they need it. Yeah.
I don't know, but like I said, I'm open to the idea of Euron being a lot more important to the plot. Maybe even the big human face of the bad by the end of the series.
Could be.
Those are things I'm going to be looking for. But I am really curious about what this gift is going to be.
Yeah.
I don't feel like we'll find out next episode either.
No.
That feels like something that's going to be more resolved in the mids. We might see him doing stuff, but we're not going to actually know what the hell is going on.
Yeah. We'll probably see him going off in a direction.
One direction?
Yeah.
He's got to choose a direction. He's got the outfit for the boy band already.
He totally does. He's the bad one. He's the little dirty one that you're not quite sure about. But
yeah, you know. We're not talking about peeing in a mop bucket bad. We're talking about like raping and pillaging bad.
He's a little worse than like
Joey
Fatone, but yeah.
After I read that Forsaken chapter, I felt like I had to go take a shower. I was like, good God, some bad shit.
Huh.
All right. That's all we got for the spoiler section. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Of course, we'll be back next week with another full lineup. Starting Sunday night, we got the Instant Take, where we come on and talk about our first impressions, followed by Tuesday, our full featured scene-by-scene recap podcast. And then next Friday, we'll have another spoiler take. I still got a couple more theories that I want to bust out on you. I'm not sure whether I want to get them all over up front or if I want to space them out over the season. Because I was hoping to get a couple special guests in here to help me do that, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's what's coming up. Send feedback into GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. I don't know if you guys were following this, but we actually ended up becoming the number one podcast on all of iTunes before the week was over.
Right.
Thank you, everyone.
Mind blown. Jesus.
As I type, we have about 500,000 people that have downloaded that podcast.
Yeah.
That is insane.
Yeah, thank you to everyone.
Thanks for everyone who's been recommending us on Reddit, who's been sharing us on social media, who's helped get us over to Hump. We are eternally grateful. I have some real quick housekeeping notes. I forgot to do this on the main podcast, but I want to thank the Highway Superstar for our fantastic Game of Thrones remix. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like an 80s television inspired. Some people call it Throne Wolf. Some people call it Throne Rider. But I think it's catchy and it's awesome. And thanks to Highway Superstar for letting us use it.
Yeah, you can find the link to all of his stuff in the show notes just go to SoundCloud, search Highway Superstar, you'll find it.
Boom. We also just recorded a podcast on Dunkirk. You can have the spoiler-free version for free. If you're a club member, you can get our spoiler-filled thoughts. We also had our playthrough of Bad Guy Javi, the final chapter in the season 3 of the Telltale Walking Dead video game. And I also recorded two nights ago a podcast with Shane Bowman of the Film Schlubs podcast about Twin Peaks. I had just gotten done watching the classic series, so we reminisced about what the fandom was like back in the day, and he kind of teased me with some of the stuff on the new show, and hopefully we'll get together to cover the new show on Showtime real soon, but that's going to be hitting early next week. And that's what's going on. You can find all this stuff at baldmove.com. Thank you very much. We will see you next week with more great Game of Thrones coverage. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.